Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. You've had enough staying home. You've had enough confinement. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth Tree Runner, the responsive foam and extra grip of the Tree Dasher, or the classic low-top look of the Tree Piper. Allbirds has a shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Whether you're traveling to the ends of the earth or settling in for a staycation, you need a shoe that's versatile enough to go with any outfit, durable enough to wear over any terrain, and lightweight enough to make packing a breeze. Being made from insanely comfortable, breezy eucalyptus fiber is a plus, too. When you wear Allbirds travel shoes, you're in vacation mode before you even leave the house. They're the only shoes your suitcase needs. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair of Tree Dashers, Runners, Pipers, and more at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Steve Abel, the editor of the TLS. Joining me this week is Henry James fan Thea Leonarduzzi, who certainly did not confuse him with Nathaniel Hawthorne last week when we talked about him on this show.
Yes. And in the heat of the moment, in my defence, yes, I said the Scarlet Letter when I meant the Portrait of a Lady, but it's not as absurd as you are so gleefully suggesting, because in his study of Hawthorne, I think you'll find Henry James did cite that as an influence.
He did, the duskiness and all of that. However, Matt, our very kind producer, edited out the mistake.
He did. He has more affection for me than you do.
He's a gentleman.
He's a gentleman. You, on the other hand, well, let's move on.
I'm a cad. It's great news that Thea is such an aficionado, as she would no doubt correctly pronounce, because this week we're devoting this podcast to the wonderful Henry James, who I once wrote two dissertations about at university. Such was my admiration for him and my sly indolence in using one set of notes twice. Today we'll be talking about the unlikely prospect of James in Los Angeles. Think Chandler, and then think completely again. And we'll talk about his novelistic output more widely. We'll be joined by two Jamesians, Philip Horn and Francis Wilson, who both have essays in the paper this week. We don't readily associate Henry James with West Coast America. We can see him in New York, of course, that neo-puritanical world of moneyed angst, and we feel his artistic impulse pushing him ever further east to nations filled with crumbling palazzi, decadent aristocracy, and the complicating pressure of a longer history. When he wrote The American Scene, the dizzying, immensely suggestive work, in the words of Philip Horn this week, a prose poem of the first order, according to Auden many years earlier, he went no further west than Florida, and many readers probably assume James didn't either, if they think about it at all. But he did, as the Los Angeles Times reported in March 1905. Henry James here, well-known novelist, alone, slips quietly into apartments at the Van Nuys. This is late James, of course, and it's hard to imagine the author of The Golden Bowl finding much inspiration in the underdeveloped streets of Los Angeles. There seems little artistically to connect James with, say, Raymond Chandler, who made much of the smoggy moral squalor just a few years later. And James was far more sensitive to the scene than the citizens. California completely bowled him over, but he was affected by the landscape, the languid lisp of the Pacific, all that nature and climate. It's often amusing to compare James's vision for his work, especially his late work, and its execution. To the master, the ideas behind the fiction always seem simple. The ambassadors, he noted, was very straight. To the red-eyed reader, those monstrously sinuous sentences are anything but. They needed, according to the Chicago Evening Post, as much application and attention as Kantian metaphysics. We feel James retains a scientific precision in his prose, an inviolable authority. It's somewhat reassuring then to chart his errors and missteps, as Francis Wilson does in the TLS this week, or to think of him as overwhelmed by the sight of the Pacific Ocean stretching out past his normal horizon. So to discuss all of this, we are joined, thankfully, by Philip Horn, author of Henry James and Revision, which I used in both of my dissertations, and Francis Wilson, biographer most recently of Thomas de Quincey and a Jamesian herself. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
Right, before we're going to talk about all the lovely stuff that you've written, why don't we try and fix where we are with the state of Henry James's reputation? Is he rising or falling stock-wise, do you think?
I think we might have come to the end of a quiet period.
Really?
I mean, there's John Banville's novel, his sequel to The Portrait of a Lady, which came out last year. There's a film of the Aspen Papers with Vanessa Redgrave, which is, was it Venice?
Yeah, that's right.
So I think there are a number of things.
You've got
coming
a book out?
I got a book out earlier this year. Yeah, which is Tales from a Master's Notebook, which is short stories by contemporary writers based on ideas from James's notebooks that James himself never got round to writing.
Why do you think, Francis, we keep returning to him collectively? Because at one level, he's a very Victorian figure. The stories are very complete and of their time. He doesn't necessarily feel like someone who would dramatically speak to our age.
I just wanted to address what Philip just said about the reputation of James. I think it's going to change dramatically with these Cambridge editions. They're so brilliantly done, and they brought James hurling back to us with such force.
How have they done that?
The precision of the editorial work, the way in which James has been caught out again and again and again as not quite the master he presents himself as being, they're enormous fun. I mean, looking at James's revisions are enormous fun. Looking at his oversights is enormous fun. There's a sense of James at work, and so not the polished, finished James, but James the craftsman sitting at his desk, working away and having blocks and anxieties and making mistakes and having a huge idea that isn't quite managing to come off. So this is, we've got a fully dimensional, many-layered human being here.
You mentioned a couple of the key mistakes, Francis. There's the two chapters in The Ambassadors which seem to be in the wrong place. There's that critical scene which I mentioned in The Portrait of a Lady, which is based on the fact that one of Madame Merle is sitting down and Osmond standing up in whatever order, and he seemed to confuse that.
Yeah, that's very, very funny. I was so struck by that in Portrait of a Lady. It's a very famous scene. It's the pivotal scene in chapter 30. And I am interested in the fact that the pivotal scenes in The Ambassadors and Portrait of a Lady both take place in chapter 30. Anyway, the pivotal scene in chapter 30 has Madame Merle and Osmond looking at each other, talking face to face. And Madame Merle is looming over Osmond. She's standing and he's sitting. And that's the image. I remember reading it when I was a teenager, and that's the image I've carried with me all my life. And then what you see in this new Cambridge edition is this mistake that James made, where initially, when Isabella sees them, Madame Merle is sitting. And he overlooked, and so he has her sitting and then suddenly standing. And James overlooked this mistake in his revisions, and it was picked out by an editor some way down the line. And so these things I find enormously sort of humanizing of James. And of course, the error in the chapter reversals in The Ambassadors is comedic in its insistence.
But is that not testament, Philip, slightly to the nature of The Ambassadors, which is we're in late James by that point. It's relatively heavy going at one reading of it. Is it not? I mean, is it hard to say what is the correct order at all for Henry James?
I think the question of whether the order of the chapters is to do with whether one is a retrospective chapter looking back to something that happened before, you know. I mean, so it's complicated anyway, and one's used to those effects in James. Yeah. You know, that very often you jump ahead and then look back. So
but is he less masterful than we give him credit for?
Yeah, I don't give him credit for being completely masterful, just sort of more masterful than nearly everybody else. You know.
He wasn't the closest of proofreaders, basically.
He was an extremely close proofreader, because I should confess an interest. I'm one of the general editors of the Cambridge edition.
Thankfully, Francis liked, otherwise this would be a very frosty conversation we're about to have.
Yes.
Imagine if Francis said, you know what, I think the Cambridge issue is really bad this
really
time.
Really let me down.
but one of the volumes I'm doing is The Golden Bull, and I'd assumed that there wouldn't be any interesting revisions in The Golden Bull, because he published in 1904 and then the revisions are 5 years later. But then there are sentences where there are 13 commas in the 1904 edition, and it goes down to one or two commas in the New York edition. So, I mean, this was a complete revelation to me.
And what was the effect of that?
Well, the effect of it is to go from this very broken up style, which you can see why people find it so hard to read, because you're kind of given all these clauses and you've got to try and relate them. And actually, it's almost like James has had some kind of revelation that you could just strip out all of that and read it steadily going through, and the meaning will just... And it's true. I mean, that I'd always read the Penguin edition, which I think uses the New York edition, and it had never given me any trouble. But just thinking about the proofreading side, I mean, to be able to remove 11 commas and still have the sentence make sense is quite a... You know, I mean, you have to analyse the sentence.
I suppose that's at the level of the sentence, when I think what I mean was just to have missed so many times the transposition of these two chapters.
I think you probably wouldn't have the idea that the chapters would be could be in the wrong order.
He had faith in his editor.
Yeah.
Hey, mistake.
did you find in your working on The Golden Bull that James was increasingly interested or disinterested in his own readability?
That's a good question.
Ooh, yes. Well, I mean, the preface to The Golden Bull famously has that thing about richly rewarding prose repays viva voce treatment, that sort of, if you read a passage out, then that out loud, that's the real test of how powerful it is. And so he's thinking that in the time of The Golden Bull. And of course, this is the period when he's dictating to a secretary. Everything, all his prose is
dictated.
Sounded out loud.
Can I ask a philistine question about The Golden Bull? Because I've read almost everything by Henry James. Do you, Francis or Philip, honestly believe there is a wide audience of people who will want to read The Golden Bull in its entirety for pleasure?
People will want to read The Golden Bull in its entirety for snobbish reasons. I think you have to be seen to know your Henry James. I don't think pleasure comes into it, but I think pleasure comes into it very deeply for me and for Philip and for you. But I think there is a snobbish value attached to Henry James.
And particularly The Golden Bowl, because it is so very, very, very hard. It is a very hard, you know, it's probably in the top 20 hard novels in terms of difficulty in reading ever written, potentially in English.
And I mean, I have to say, the thing that got me into reading James was... going up to university and sharing a kitchen with somebody who had read The Golden Bull and was completely insufferable about it.
and saying you weren't
civilised unless you had read The Golden Bull and so on. So I went home my first vacation and I sat down for 3 weeks and I read The Golden Bull and I just was converted. But, you know, I mean, I was reading 7 pages an hour, maybe. Right. I mean, it's like poetry, you know. But there's nothing more rewarding and nothing... At a certain level, it's a really... profound pleasure.
But so because The Golden Bull is so different to early James, do we need to think about, in terms of how James is thought of in the popular imagination and received popularly, do we need to think about splitting him? The style is so different, it's almost like two different writers.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's certainly the James of The Turn of the Screw, which continues to have a kind of popular appeal, and they make a film every 6 months or something. And then the Aspen Papers and the Portrait of a Lady, which are
middle James. But also, there's an argument. I mean, you guys might disagree, but it seems to me that in some ways the peak of his novelistic output is The Portrait of a Lady, because it combines both some of the judgment and some of that attenuated beauty of the later novels with still being a great piece of Victorian fiction. You could put against Bleak House, you could put against those sort of baggy monsters of the 19th century. Is Portrait of a Lady not the thing you'd hang your hat on?
I mean, if I were recommending one James novel to a new reader, it would always be Portrait of a Lady, not The Golden Bull, I think. They were very snobbish.
What about you, Francis? Do you think we can make a case that The Portrait is at least is the greatest?
I don't think so. I mean, I love the portrait, but I think it's too George Eliot, if you like. I don't think it's Henry James enough. I like James when he gets really, really tangled.
Oh my! So you are extreme Jamesian. Is that what you're saying here? You're for three last novels.
I am. I like to feel the tension in his writing and the tension in his thought. And I like it when the sentences become really knotty with 800 commas.
Really? Is that just you admiring complexity for its own sake, though, Frances?
No, it's not, because I don't like complexity for its own sake. It's something much more visceral than that. And I've never really been able to understand it. But I think it's to do with my dual reading of James, that I always read James's novels alongside the notebooks and letters. And so what interests me is the difference between what he sets out to achieve and what he eventually achieves, and why his descriptions of what he's setting out to achieve are so lucid and so clear and so fluent, and why the eventual product is so strangled. Yeah. And I love what's going on in the space between.
Because this idea that the ambassadors is very straight.
It's not straight.
It's obviously not straight at all, and it's a very hard. That again, it's late again, so it's a very hard going book. At one level, Lambert Streth, who's the central character, gives the "live all you can" speech, but he just observes for 400 pages.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. E.M. Forster describes the hourglass structure in the ambassadors, doesn't he? That it sort of crosses over, that, you know, Strether comes over with one mission. He's trying to bring back the erring Chad, and at the end, the erring Chad decides to go back, and Strether is trying to stop him. So they've kind of switched positions. Yes. I mean, and Forster didn't really like James, but he does describe this as a kind of perfect structure. So, I mean, maybe that's what he means about the straightness of the ambassadors.
What do we know then about the way that Henry James set out to make his fiction? What did he value? How did he approach it? Quite often there are the anecdotes or the kind of the thought experiments that then become something that is just not at all straight.
Yeah, the Donne.
The Donne. Well, very often he... I'm also editing for myself the notebooks again from manuscript, which has been a bit mad. But
so you get to see his handwriting.
I mean, trying to make it out as well.
How bad is his handwriting?
It's some periods it's quite good, but mostly it's quite difficult. And there are always, I mean, actually, a reasonable number of errors in the existing transcription. So,
oh, really? And does he wander around with a little notebook jotting down?
Mostly not, I think. Mostly it's at his desk. But there is, there's another unwritten book, London Town, which he was going to do. He signed the contract in 1903 and then tried to write it for about 5 years. And he would periodically go out into the streets of London and wander around with a notebook, jotting things down and saying, you know, there are two tramps gnawing a chicken bone down at the end of the churchyard.
Did he dictate his notebook entries as well towards the end, or were these always handwritten?
The notebooks, strictly speaking, are always handwritten, but he did dictate scenarios and plans for novels, sometimes for publishers and sometimes just for his own use.
Were there any left when he died then?
Yes, yeah. I mean, two in the Cambridge edition. We're going to have they're nearly done now. The Ivory Tower and The Sense of the Past, the two unfinished novels, and there's quite a lot of material for those. And actually, some really interesting Sense of the Past material, where he was dictating a passage of the novel, then he would have an idea for how to do the rest of the story, and he'd just carry on, kind of planning the story after, you know, this passage of fiction. And then these were put in the Houghton Library as discarded sheets, so nobody, I think, looked at them for years. But they've got all this sort of interesting material, notebook material.
Frances, how do you envisage him as a writer? Because if you read the notebooks, I suppose there's the idea, there's the little summary, and then there's sometimes a list of names, and then he sometimes comes back to it, he leaves it for a little bit. When you... Because you're a biographer, do you have a sort of imaginary James in your mind?
It's always the James of the notebooks. I absolutely adore the notebooks. I can't wait for this new, for Phillips edition. I think the notebooks are fascinating and very, very moving. And one of the things I love about them are the refrains that run through. Like, one of them is, what is there in the idea of too late? and he capitalizes the T and he capitalizes the L. And this idea of lateness, being too late on the scene, being too late in his own life, it's very open what he means by too late, runs all the way through. And I've been thinking about this for years and years and years, what he means by this. And then when we talk about late Henry James, I always think, is it too late? Are we talking about too late Henry James? What does lateness mean for him? And I wonder with Philip, if I could just ask Philip, are there other refrains which are as haunting and as melancholic that you've detected running through the notebooks as a whole?
I can't think of anything as melancholic. I mean, dramatized and all that. I mean, those things.
Yes.
And the way he talks to Monbon, isn't it? His yes. tutelary spirit who's going to...
Yes.
who's always with him. I mean, they're very... Yeah, I mean, they are very unguarded in a certain way.
I think we're going to come back in a moment. We're going to talk about the unknown James, which takes us back to Philip's piece, which is him romping around LA. So we'll come to that next.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm struck, guys, when we talk about Henry James, there's an awful lot. He wrote these voluminous notes, there's letters, he wrote prefaces to all of his novels, or most of his novels, so you actually, where he set down why he wrote them, he revised them. So we know so much about him. And yet, there's lots of parts of his life which are a mystery. You know, there's the obscure hurt which took him out of the Civil War, which may or may not have been impotence. There's his sex life, his romantic inclinations. Do you find that odd that we know so much and so little at the same time about him? Is that one of the reasons why we keep sort of endlessly returning to him, like a Jamesian character?
I suppose... One thing is just that there are 20 novels and 100 and whatever it is, short stories. I mean, there's almost more than than most people want to read. So, but there are these great masterpieces. And so kind of when you've read one, you feel the need, the urge to read more. But there's always this kind of hinterland of stuff that you don't know. And I mean, also, I confess I've been reading James, you know, most of my adult life. And I've forgotten an awful lot. So I keep discovering things that I probably knew when I was 20, but, you know.
He's kind of unfair. In a way that Jane Austen, Francis, is kind of, you know, her fiction. You can read 6 books and you're done to a certain extent. I know some of the bits and bobs. But James, has anyone ever read all of James? And then therefore, has anyone ever fully understood him?
Well, I think that James is very, reading James is very determined by age, and we talk about, you know, sort of early James and middle James and late James. And I think that reading middle James in one's own middle age is a very different experience to reading middle James when you're 18. And the Ambassadors, it's late James, but it's about middle age. It's about a 56-year-old man, and The Jolly Corner is about another 56-year-old man. And I find as I move through my 50s, I'm more and more interested in what James has to say about being middle-aged. And I'd missed all this when I was reading him as a teenager.
He's almost prematurely middle-aged, Henry James, isn't he?
He is, yes.
He feels like he was born with a bald pate and a slight angst. Let's go to Philip's piece, because I didn't know about this at all. Philip, he went to the west coast of America. We associate him with the East. We associate him with Europe. We don't associate him with downtown LA.
Yeah. I think through an agency, negotiated a kind of an amazing lecture tour, which is one of the ways people, it was his way of funding his travels, partly. And it was mainly ladies' clubs. And in fact, there were jokes in the press about how only women could understand Henry James. And there was one lecture in Chicago where a newspaper report said that three men were spotted in the audience, but one was asleep, one was trapped and couldn't get out, and the other one was forced to stay by his wife or something. I mean, he was seen as a writer for ladies, and also incredibly difficult, so that, you know, people could speak French, German, and Henry James. That was another thing that they said in the papers. One of the interesting things about doing this piece, because I'd always known there was this Western aspect, and I'd been gradually collecting bits and pieces over the years. But of course, now you can look in, the kind of databases of historical newspapers are very easy to search. And so you just find how much of a media figure he was on this whole trip. And people were making up news about him when they couldn't.
So what were they saying?
Well, in the interview which Julian Hawthorne did with him, which I use in the piece, which is a really interesting...
Hawthorne's son, Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Yes, son of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Again,
there you go. Of Scarlet Letter fame.
One of the things, I didn't have space for this in the piece, James complains about the phone and how you're always being... He's in a hotel and people just ring him up all the time. And so he was at his morning ablutions and the phone rang and there was a lady interviewer wanting to talk to him. And so he kind of looks quizzically at Julian Hawthorne, and this then gets repeated in other newspapers, but kind of enormously elaborated, so that James is given this line of dialogue: "Why, madam, it is impossible. I'm in a semi-nude state of dress." So they love making up these kind of James. It's a kind of dude humour, I think. James is the ultimate dude in the West. But I mean, the lovely thing about the LA section of his travels is that I think he was a bit tired bored after 3 days in the Great Plains, which he calls a single, boundless, empty platitude. And so he's sort of sitting around in the lobby of the hotel, and these journalists come up and he talks to them. And I found this very nice sort of interview where they try and ask him questions and he asks them questions instead. And the journalist has caught on, and so that he's kind of that these little stubs of questions are asked, and then James just comes out with this torrent of curiosity about California. So there's quite a record of him in LA.
Did you know he went to LA, Frances?
No, I didn't. I was really fascinated by this. It was extraordinary. I was also struck by the fact that it was headline news.
Yeah, I can't believe that.
Henry James appears in LA. How could that be headline news? I mean, had nothing else happened that day?
There wasn't so much happening, I think, in LA in those days.
LA by that point is still pretty frontiery, isn't it? I mean, it's not been that long since the Gold Rush and all of those.
And there's
things.
No Hollywood yet or any of that. I think Rider Haggard was there at the same time.
Was he? And Chandler was 10 years away. Chandler comes to LA in 1913, I think. So it's a very different LA that he starts to write about than Henry James.
And in a sense, Henry James was Hollywood. He brought the show, and they didn't really know what to do with him. What did he make of California?
Well, he loves it. I mean, the nature. I think I also didn't have room for his trip to Coronado Beach. He goes to the Coronado... which is the hotel they use in Some Like It Hot for Florida.
How did you not include this in the
I know, I know.
What's going on?
I know.
Bury the lead.
And he writes this wonderful, one of the most moving notebook entries in the whole thing, where he remembers going to visit the family grave in Cambridge, Massachusetts on this cold night just at dusk, and the pink sky and the kind of sun is setting over the Soldiers Field Stadium on the other side of the Charles River, and so on. He's doing all this from this kind of Pacific coast hotel. I mean, I'll keep digging and see if how much more there is, but I think LA is the core of it.
And he could have continued the American scene, but never got around to it.
And he goes to all these interesting places, sort of weird Buddhist educational establishments and so on. It would be wonderful to have James writing about those.
Your piece reminded me of a kind of a Jamesian story, you know, because your piece was about a piece he didn't write, what James didn't write about California. It reminded me of the Jolly Corner, you know, what he might have done had he gone back to New York.
Yeah, it was too late. Well, I mean, he went back too early.
Too late. He's not a commercial figure, isn't he, I suppose? That's the thing that strikes me, that even in this, it's all about the deal he can strike with a publisher. Every time he has an idea, he's got his agent trying to flog it. I mean, for someone who's so auteurial in some respects, he's a very commercial figure.
Yeah, James. Yeah. I mean, I think Michael Inesco, in his first book, Friction with the Market, I mean, he was trying to kind of knock down the idea of James as this ivory tower figure who kind of was above the market and didn't care. I mean, James always was trying to do his best.
Was he trying to write bestsellers?
In one sense, yes. I don't think he went the full... I mean, I don't think he was really prepared to compromise, so he never did. But
How bestseller... Do you know this, friends? How bestseller... I mean, it was Portrait of a Lady with these Dickensian-sized books. I've got no concept of the popularity otherwise. Do you know, Francis?
No, I don't. No, I'd be interested to hear what Philip says about that.
What
numbers was James selling in? Yeah. Was he selling primarily to women?
I think the highest figures were probably for the Daisy Miller, but then that was pirated, so he made next to nothing by it, he said. I think Portrait of a Lady was a little bit kind of... It was fine. It was a kind of, so to say, d'esteem, but it wasn't... None of them were really big hits. The Golden Bowl, strangely, because it came out as he went on tour in the States, and there was all this publicity around him, you know, and I think people were buying it, you know, a little bit in the way they bought Brief History of Time or something, to have it on their shelves.
It's one of the great unread books.
Yeah, and or, you know, probably there are lots of copies with the pages cut for the first 20 pages, you know, and...
Curious, Philip, what you were saying about Henry James being associated with women readers. Because on the one hand, we have Henry James being associated with impossibility and incredible complexity and unreadability. On the other hand, it's only good for women readers. And so how can we kind of marry that sense of women readers not having much up top, but only being able to read Henry James?
No, that's a great compliment to women readers, isn't it?
But it seems anachronistic.
Big a compliment to women readers.
You don't buy
at the
it.
Time.
Yeah, you don't buy it.
No, I'm just surprised. I'm surprised that on the one hand, we have what's known as women's fiction, which is pretty low down the scale. On the other hand, we have Henry James is read mainly by women. You think, well, it's, I mean, Henry James, super overeducated writer. Yeah. So what's going on there?
Well, I mean, one of my still unwritten projects is a book on Henry James and Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt... kind of hated James's work insofar as he read it. But Mrs. Roosevelt was a fan.
Really? They're quite temperamentally opposed, Teddy Roosevelt and Henry James.
Yes, you know, yes.
They
really are a kind of great double act in a way. So Mrs. Roosevelt liked James's writing. And I think, well, one of the things in among American writers at the time, this is particularly the Roosevelt circle with Owen Wister and the kind of Western writers, that they're very opposed to what they think of as teacups or kind of, you know, the social comedy and all that kind of stuff that's really a bit unmanly.
This is the time of the Virginian, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, although Owen Wister actually was very keen on James, and James was very keen on the Virginian.
Which is the first, it's the first cowboy story they think. But were not novel readers of that time predominantly women?
An awful lot were.
So is the form not a female form, Francis? Maybe that's the point, that it was just maybe it was just seen as an occupation for women who didn't work. They had time to read novels.
I think that's a really good point, having time, yes.
Which you do.
And also Henry James being a civilising process. You know, reading Henry James made you a more civilised person. Improved your manners.
Which would be a factor, actually, in America at that time, because you always think that America is a complete country, but throughout Henry James's life, it was pushing west
yes. into uncivilized territory.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's... Yeah. That,
so imagine that's LA, were pleased that any,
right.
LA were pleased yes. that any New York novelist had made the trip.
Yeah.
Yes.
To come back to the women readers thing, just a second, how did Henry James feel about that? Was he happy with that? Because in your piece, I think it is, you mention that he was going to write more for, I think it was Harper's, and the editor at the time said, can you just come at it from a woman's perspective? Can you really hone it for that particular demographic? And he never did do that. Do you think he tired of it?
Well, he had written about 8 pieces for Harper's Bazaar already. And I suppose the pieces he was thinking of were travel pieces, so kind of giving them the woman's angle wasn't necessarily so easy. I mean, the pieces he had written were on the speech of American women and the manners of American women. So they were kind of directly up the Harper's Bazaar street.
I love the fact that in that period, if you want to have someone write about women, you get a man to do it.
Get Henry James to do it.
Yeah. We need something from a female perspective, Henry. Can you? We could ask a woman, but actually, would you just give it a go? And he managed to churn out 8 pieces on it. I don't imagine he was a very good lecturer.
Well, there are differing accounts, not surprisingly. In some places, he was thought to be not very audible. And in some places, he was thought not to be very expressive. But then other people said, if you listened carefully, it was wonderfully rich and suggestive. And, you know, they loved it. And they, you know, hung on every word. So, I've absolutely no idea because, you know, we have no idea what Henry James's voice sounded like even.
What do you think, Fred? I imagine you need an attention span of some degree to sit through a Henry James lecture.
I imagine listening to Henry James was a bit like listening to Coleridge's table talk. That it was just the sentences were too long.
I think that's probably right. I've got something crass and populist to ask at the end, Thea, about consigning and picking our favourites. Is there anything else you want to cover? I think we've gone through a lot of a lot of James here.
Well, yeah, and this sort of goes into what you're about to ask then, because the last week when you asked me to nominate a favourite work,
yes,
on the spot, cruelly,
yes, cruelly, but which
I eventually decided on Washington Square.
Yes,
I completely agree.
I'm interested in the fact that Henry James himself, he didn't like it. I think he chose not to include it in the New York edition that he was preparing towards the early 1900s, 1907 or something, was it?
Yeah.
Why do we love it? And why did he hate it? I know why I like it.
I wouldn't say he hated it. I mean, there were constraints of space for the New York edition. And then I think there's also a little bit of a kind of teleology of, He's telling the story of his own evolution as a novelist, and Washington Square doesn't quite fit into it so much because it's sort of more in the Jane Austen. That the narrator is a kind of very kind of a sort of omniscient, ironic, commenting narrator. Probably also Catherine Sloper is not one of these fine consciences in the way that Isabel Archer is, for example. She's not so sensitive to, you know, what's going on around her. But I mean. But it's a great achievement, obviously.
Why do you like it? Why do you like it, Dave?
I like the simplicity of it. I like how muted it is, and I like Catherine as a heroine.
Why do you like it, Frances?
I like its cruelty, and I like the way that Dr. Sloper looks deeply into the suffering that he's caused.
Yeah,
I think it's
a
brilliant study of domestic cruelty, and I like its length and I like its New Yorkness.
I think it's
perfect.
New York in evening yeah. in it is brilliantly done. I think.
Oh, and there was an excellent film as well, wasn't there?
The Heiress.
Yeah.
The fact that it's been filmed so well, was it The Heiress?
Exactly. Yeah, with Olivia de Havilland.
Montgomery Cliff.
Exactly.
And Ralph Richardson. Yeah.
Exactly.
And I think that's helped enormously with making the book accessible. But the film is wonderful on its own. I remember seeing the film without knowing that it was that it was Washington Square.
And there have been so many, and you mentioned this at the very beginning, actually, Philip, about the new Aspen Papers film. There have been so many successful adaptations of James. Is it just that his prose is just so...
I find it extraordinary.
I don't think so. No, it's so...
Well, he's terribly interested in point of view, and that works very well with film if it's done right. I mean, you know, there was a book on Henry James and Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah. I mean, but I guess the reason he failed in the theatre was he was incapable, it seems to me, of telling a clear action-based story, which is one of the factors in film as well, isn't it? He wouldn't have written a good film.
I've got a slightly guilty liking for the plays.
The plays. I thought I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, so. I mean, most of them are comedies, and they're actually quite funny. I mean, if you know, the more serious stuff is very dated.
Yeah, but he couldn't make it in the theatre. He failed there. Francis talks about that briefly. Would he have made good films? He probably wouldn't, would he?
Not by himself, no.
right, my crassly populist thing to do, I'm going to start with you, Francis, is you have to name one book that you can only ever read. If you can never read Henry James again, only one book that you'd pick and one book that you would consign to eternal darkness as you wish he'd never written.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think the book has to be Washington Square.
To keep, okay.
To keep. The one I consign to, The Tragic Muse.
Oh, no.
Oh, you've broken Philip Horn. Philip Horn's edition.
To consign my edition. To,
Why The Tragic Muse?
I just can't get on with it.
Yeah.
I can't get on with it. I've struggled and struggled and struggled. And even though I like the difficulty and I like the pain thresholds, I can't do it. I can't get through it.
It's his funniest novel, I think.
Philip, it's gone. It's gone.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
Name, one to keep, one to consign.
Well, to keep The Golden Bowl, probably, because... you'd never feel you've quite cracked it. And I don't know what to get rid of. Something minor, I suppose. A little tour in France. I don't particularly care about. Yeah. I mean, I like it.
Okay. Thea, do you want anything you want to consign or keep?
I'd keep Washington Square, and I'd probably add The Turn of the Screw, actually. Because
to
I can
consign.
Read it again. No, to keep.
You can get them in sort of editions.
Exactly, with the Aspen papers, usually it comes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's a good one. That's a good book to keep. That's a good book to keep. Anyone you want to consign? Anything you particularly...
No, I haven't read The Golden Bowl, so I couldn't possibly say.
I'm not against consigning The Golden Bowl because I find it very difficult. I'm going to keep Portrait of a Lady because I can't believe otherwise we're not keeping it. The great novel. Mm. Princess Casamassima? Not an enjoyable read, as James tries to do Dickens unsuccessfully.
Not very.
I just reread it. It's very disturbing, I think.
Yeah.
It's not. Anyway, I don't think it's anybody's favourite.
No, you're not going to throw anything at me for that. No. Thankfully, Francis, you're in New York, so you can't. Philip can't throw anything at you for The Tragic Muse going after he's so painstakingly edited it as well.
Oh dear. Well, I'm sure. Well, his edition will transform everything.
Stop trying to sell his editions, Francis.
It's all right.
Yeah, what have you said to her before we came on air? That's all we've got time for this week. I think we've definitely covered Henry James. Our thanks go to Francis Wilson and Philip Horn. Make sure you're subscribing not only to this podcast, but the TLS itself. This week in the paper, we have a Middle East special section touching on Turkey, Iran and terrorism. Next week, the paper has a history special, so we may drag onto this podcast history editor and Arsenal fan David Horspool, or we may just abuse him from afar. We haven't worked that out yet, Thea, have we yet?
No. No. We like to keep things...
Unprepared.
Unprepared here. Flexible.
Flexible. That's a good way of putting it. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.